Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode, I think this is number 7 of the Do the Secret Monkey podcast. We have a special guest today, Luis Palanker, documentarian, podcast, and radio, and just wears a lot of hats. We'd like to welcome you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, we became aware of you through the Cow Sills film, Family Band. And we enjoyed it so much, we actually just bought it. You know, we had streamed it so much, so now we own it. Mm-hmm. But, and of course, there's so much about your career we'd like to ask you about, but maybe that being a common touchstone, we've had them on our podcast and we've been on theirs. How did you come about the idea of perhaps them as a subject? And tell us the beginnings of that.
Well, I wanted to make the film that I wanted to see. So, because I had a lot of unanswered questions about the Cow Sills. So for me, it was just sort of an interesting exploration to sort of figure out. I figured if I was one of maybe a million kids in their fan club, I wasn't the only one who wanted to know what happened and why were these like beautifully gifted children denied, really expansive careers in their adult lives. Like something derailed them. Clearly, Jefferson, that children need a ton and then they'll flourish because they're awesome. And your kids are a really good shining example of that. Just give a little water, a little love, and look at them blossom. And I didn't understand why, children would be this talented and then as adults, we're not hearing from them. So really what happened? And I just went in search of that. And it was really the internet. You know, a lot of people at my age and your age, we kind of went, oh, you can search for things online. Like, what's the first thing you searched for? Like, for me, one of the first things I searched for probably on Yahoo, back in the day was the Cow Sills, and the fans had already put together a website for them. So it's pretty easy to see, like, oh my gosh, this, I know it was in the year 2000, I think, because I saw that the Cow Sills were all gathering at the Taste of Rhode Island Fair, and I wasn't going to be able to make it out. It was coming right up. So that was around when I did that first search. But I did post on their message board or something, and a fellow fan named Karen Oldfield, she wrote to me and said, oh, I see you live in L.A. You should come see Bob at this pub where he performs. So that was what launched it.
Wow. Well, you mentioned that Taste of Rhode Island show. I think most of it is on video. Someone captured it on a video camera of that era. And musically, it's probably one of the best things they left behind as far as Bill and Barry being able to see them play together.
Yeah.
And have you ever seen that, Ella or Lionel?
No.
I'll show it to you. It's well, one of the coolest things about it is it's the first time I ever heard the song. A Thousand Times, which is the current single by John Cowsill and Vicki Peterson.
Right.
And of course, I thought it was an old 50s era, honky tonk classic. I had no clue that Bill had a hand in that song.
It has that feeling, doesn't it? You knew how to capture that vibe.
Yeah. Well, the fact that you, so you contacted them, you discovered their website in 2000. When did you actually begin on the documentary itself, or how did you approach them about that?
I went to the pub to meet Karen from the message board, and there were a lot of Cow Sills fans there, and I just thought, oh, that's a natural occurrence, and I was nervous. I mean, in my radio career, I've interviewed thousands of celebrities, but I was extremely nervous to meet Bob Cow Sill because I just reverted back to being 11 years old. For me, it was very nerve-wracking. Their pictures were on the wall of my childhood where I sat and dreamed, about what my life could become. And so it just meant a lot to me personally, as I think at what you love at 12, you love forever. You may go through a period where you say, I was never into New Kids, but like, okay, you still love Joey. Come on. So I just feel like that's in your heart forever. it may not be cool for a few years, but like by the time you're 27, it's cool again. You'll go on a New Kids cruise. Oh yeah. Bob sat down right next to me, and I stopped eating. I was freaked out, but it turned out to be the night that John and Vicky got married. And now that's the universe speaking to you, right? So
Right.
they just extended their wedding party into this pub, and they all come streaming in, everybody. And there's Paul, and there's, Barry, and that was crazy. I was just like watching the posters on my wall grow up and come to life.
Yeah.
Like looking at their relationships with each other was what I found most interesting. And the way I saw Paul interacting with his son Brendan, that was so much warmth. I knew that he was okay. Like, because I was thinking, if you have a kid who's grown and loves you, you're doing fine. You're doing
Yeah.
that's a successful life. And that, I didn't have to worry, that the Cowsills were fine, but not all of them were.
Yeah.
Paul's a very healthy Cowsill, but the fans started talking about this or that with their dad and whatever, and I thought, well, I was in radio at that time, but I thought I have to figure out how to make a movie because I want to know, I want there to be a movie that tells the world how amazing these people are and what was taken from them, this potential. So I thought about it, scripted movie with actors and everything, but when that wasn't going to work, that's really a hard world to enter from radio. It seems like all of show business should be connected, but there's like separate funnels, and I figured I can make a documentary myself. I don't have to get a film studio to approve a script, and I could pick up a camera and make a documentary. And when it looked like they were going to be invited to Fenway to sing the national anthem, I thought, well, that event will come and go whether I'm there or not, so I better be there. And with their permission, me and Ian Broyles tagged along. And that's a lot of the footage that you see in the film.
Right. So that's some of the first footage you got of them.
Yeah, that is exactly the first footage. I mean, I did put on a benefit concert for Billy. I helped Bob put on a benefit concert for Billy, but that was filmed. So
Oh yeah.
I think that's actually the first footage that was filmed. Yeah.
Gotcha. Wow. So that movie that we can, I think this even the music is on streaming services too. So it's that concert in 04 maybe.
Yeah, a lot of the footage that you're talking about is footage that's on my YouTube channel.
Yeah. Right.
So whatever I have that I could put up on YouTube for people to just enjoy. In fact, it was a fan that was at the Taste of Rhode Island concert who sent me her footage, and I digitized it and put that up. There's another guy that was there who probably has better footage. His name is Gary Strobel. I don't know where his footage is, but back in 2000, people had camcorders if they had anything. No one had a phone that was taking any video.
Right.
So I think Gary would have had the most professional equipment, and I don't know where what he's done with his footage, but
Right.
it should be online for everyone to enjoy because that was the last time that all of them were together, even with Richard joining them. So that was a pretty special event.
Yeah, that's right. Well, now it gives me sort of an idea of the scope of how the production went when it began. I wanted to touch back on something that you said earlier, though, about being a young girl and listening to records and so forth, and if they ever had TV appearances. We were watching Mad Men about 2 weeks ago, and we noticed Sally Draper at an age, I don't know, 14 or 13, and there was a tiger beat lying on her bed. And of course, we thought it was the one that inspired our band name, because that's where we got our name. Was Secret Monkey Weekend was a story in Tiger Beat, and it was a cover story. And in green lettering, it said Secret Monkey Weekend, spelled the way of the band, the Monkees. And when we were thinking of a band name, it's like, wow, that would be a pretty terrific name. Of course, some friends later said, well, Farewell to Fang would be a good name too, because that was actually one of the stories. I think Fang from Paul Revere and the Raiders. Herman and the Girls is like, no, we can't be Herman and the Girls. So we chose Secret Monkey Weekend, and it just seemed perfect for what we were doing. They were like something like
Eight and
13
13.
and 8 and 13,
Yeah.
so they seemed to be about the right age.
Aww.
So we've been playing ever since. But I'm imagining you as the young Sally Draper with your 45s on the bed and looking at a tiger beat. And didn't you say that you were an aspiring drummer when you were young?
Yeah, I was born a drummer, so I don't even know if the word aspiring is the right word because I just It just came with me, but I wasn't permitted to drum. So this was the push-pull in of my childhood was like just longing to be in a family like the Cowsills, where you were allowed to express whatever it was that, there's that quote that Barbara says when the kids are on Ed Sullivan. He asks her where did this come from? And she said they just all had it in them and it had to come out.
That's
Well,
right.
I wasn't allowed to let it out. So I'm drumming on the bed, I'm still like, my mom had her hands full. I mean, my dad had lost his ability to walk. He had suffered from polio
Sorry.
and he was in a wheelchair, and my mom had four kids all under the age of five, and I think drums was like that was going to be the thing that would have pushed her right over the edge. And
Yeah.
so yeah, as soon as I grew up, I bought a drum set. And I've just always known how to drum. It's just, and one of you girls is a drummer, right?
I am
Lila, yeah.
the young one.
Okay. Was it just for you, just something that you just always found yourself doing to music? Or did you say, I want to learn that, and someone taught you?
Well, I guess I guess kind of my experience with it is well, our me and Ella's biological father was mostly a drummer, and he played in all
Right.
kinds of bands throughout his
Right.
life, and we just had drum kits all around the house, and
Yeah.
I'd occasionally hit on them sometimes. But I think around age 8 or 9, I was really interested in learning,
Yeah.
and I kind of taught myself the basics, but I did also do some drum lessons, like at the guitar center. And
Ah.
yeah,
Yeah. So yeah, they were like you. I think maybe Lila was born a drummer too.
yeah, I think
It
so too.
just so that when their dad died, it just so happened that, being a musician myself and Ella just learning bass, had an opportunity to have three instruments that are band instruments, and so we ran with it. Let me ask you this: did growing up, how many siblings did you have?
I am the middle girl with a youngest brother. So there's four kids: Amy, me, Joanne, and Craig.
Okay. And where did you grow up?
We grew up in suburban Buffalo, New York, a town called Williamsville.
Okay. Just trying to think. I was up that way a couple of times, but it had nothing to do with music. But I always told Laura that if things get worse in this country, I would like to keep moving north. And of course, now Laura wants to move south. So I would like to go, beyond Buffalo and get into Canada. But that, I don't think we'll ever agree to that. So anyway, I love the cold weather. Then you ended up in California. How did that work out?
Well, I want, when one path is closed, you just open other circuitry. Like, so, whatever happened internally when I was like trying to find something that I could, at which I could excel. I'm also a good writer, and I'm a, like an idea, like a good idea, creative person. And I wanted to get into the entertainment business, and that's not something that you say out loud in suburban Buffalo, because it's not like there's anyone else doing that. And so I had family that live in California, and I wanted to get warm. I wanted to warm up a little bit, and I wasn't permitted to go to college in California. My parents had to put four kids through college. So we had to stay on the East Coast, and every family has rules regarding that. What's the best idea for colleges? Because you're still, for 4 years, you're still sort of a kid and everything. So, but I knew as soon as I finished with college that I'd be heading out to California. And then I just had to figure out, well, how do you get into the entertainment business? Well, when I was a kid, we took a trip out to California, and I saw these studio pages. They're like ushers
Right.
at a TV show. And I thought, well, I started talking to the page. I was like 11, started talking. Of course, we went looking for the Cowsills and didn't find them.
Yeah.
But I started talking to the page, and like, what do you do and how do you do it? And I thought, well, that, he just said this is an entry level position to get into the entertainment business. And I thought, well, I'm going to be a page. And then we were driving home, and we passed a school that was called the Page School. Now, this is just a private school with the name the Page School.
Sure.
But in my little brain, I thought, oh, you have to go to a special college to become a page. They're never going to let me do that. So, It's just funny how little you know when you're doing all your imagining, you know. You can imagine and imagine, and then all of a sudden there's a door that shuts in your imagination because you don't have enough information to even imagine properly. But
Right.
yeah, but I wound up getting a job as a page. Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. So that was at, let's see, that was during high school or after college?
Oh, yeah, after college, yeah. So I went to college at a state school in New York State called Brockport. We have our SUNY system, State Universities of New York.
Yeah.
And they're all peppered all over New York State. And I went to SUNY Brockport. And
yeah.
And then I was student teaching. You know, I got my teaching degree. And then after about half a year, I mustered up the courage to say, I'm going to go to grad school in California and get my master's in teaching. And I did a semester of that while I looked for jobs as a page, you know. Because I figured once I land one, I can write to my dad and say, like, I'm going to drop out of graduate school. I figured you could drop out of graduate school and go into show business.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
Well, I've got one more question, and then I'm going to turn it over to Ella and Lila. But how did you get into radio, and how did that lead to the Premier Radio Networks? And what was your role in that?
Okay. I started in television. I was a page on a studio lot called Metro Media Square. They had a local channel there, our channel 11, which is a local channel here in LA. And then they also had sound stages that they rented out to production companies. And these shows went on various networks. They were just renting the sound stage. So the shows that were taping the year that I was a page were a lot of Norman Lear sitcoms. So there were a lot of kids that were actors. And so that was cool because we were all close in age. So they did Facts of Life, Different Strokes, One Day at a Time, The Jeffersons, Give Me a Break.
Uh-huh.
And they did a talk show called The John Davidson Show. And it was John Davidson had inherited the Mike Douglas talk show.
Right.
So I immediately went to work trying to get internships on these shows because I figured if I'm a page, when I'm not working as a page, I could be working in one of these offices and learning production. So I got an internship with the John Davidson talk show, and that led to them offering me a job, and I got a job on a show called PM Magazine. And then so I was in TV for a couple of years, and then on this show called PM Magazine, they had one of the local disc jockeys named Rick Dees. He came on TV for a week to host PM Magazine.
Yeah.
And I was told this guy is funny.
Yeah.
And by this point I knew I wanted to really kind of focus on comedy, but Kiss FM requires an FM radio, and I had a Honda Civic hatchback with an AM only radio.
Yeah.
I had never heard Rick Dees. I had just been told he was funny. So I'm writing all this copy for him that's funny. And he wound up offering me a job writing his new countdown show called the Rick Dees Weekly Top 40, which would involve leaving TV and going to radio.
Right.
But I was so driven by that, the comedy aspect of the writing, that I left my TV job and went to write for Rick Dees. So that's where I switched into radio. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Well, I'm familiar with him for two reasons. One is he went to my alma mater. He went to North Carolina State.
North Carolina State, right.
And he might have done a little bit at UNC, which is right up the road. We're sort of in between Duke and University of North Carolina.
Oh, that's a great area. Yeah.
And then, of course, I don't know. I hope this means something to Ellen Lytle, but he was the guy who had the hit with Disco Duck.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lytle, I think Disco Duck is sort of like the jumping the shark of disco.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. we pin the downfall on Rick Dees. Okay.
Yeah, it's like, let's pull this back a notch. I think we've gone too far.
That's funny.
But I love disco music, and I love Happy Days. So, you know, it's all good for me.
That's right. Well, I was in college in the early 80s. I graduated in 85. I should have graduated in 84. But so, yeah, disco was sort of waning by then. But that era was something I was very in tune with. So that was it. I just wanted to maybe see how you got into radio. But maybe Premier Networks, how did that get into play?
All right. So I'm writing for Rick Dees, which I was doing at Kiss FM in Los Angeles. And I met, and all my friends were the other disc jockeys, because I was writing that show by myself, and so there were no coworkers. And I there was an office that they gave me that was really meant to be the KISS AM newsroom, but there was no KISS AM news, so it was just like an empty little room with windows where I put my typewriter and started writing.
Right.
There were no computers. You know, I just wrote all day. And I would also get to interview the acts because Rick wanted interviews on his weekly top 40. It was a 4-hour countdown show. So I had to learn everything I could about imagine learning everything you could about 40 different acts without the internet.
Right.
You know, you're calling record labels and saying, could you fax me a bio? You're going and getting all the music magazines. You're cutting out articles. You're just doing whatever research you can do to try to figure out more about this person that you can write about. But interviewing them was a huge help. So I would interview all the artists that came up to KISS FM. At that time when radio was like all people listened to, there wasn't podcasts. KISS FM in Los Angeles had a 10 share, which meant that 10% of people in Los Angeles with hundreds of stations, 10% were listening to KISS FM. So right. Radio stations across the country started calling themselves KISS FM, even if their call letters did not remotely spell the word KISS.
Right.
You know, ours did. They were KISS.
Yeah.
But yeah, it became such a popular handle because we would have been so successful. And that's because of Rick Dietz. He was just killing it in the mornings. I mean, he was just so good. And I was writing his syndicated show, which went a top 40 show. He would do his morning show 4 hours every morning, and then he would record his syndicated show, which would go out all across the nation. And then some of the other disc jockeys, which became my really good friends, they decided they wanted to get into syndication too. And so we put together this idea called the Plane Rap Countdown.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was there was an afternoon guy at KISS FM named Big Ron O'Brien. And every Friday afternoon, he would count down the top 40, and he would use sound bites from all the different artists that we had interviewed. So it's like you're listening to Big Ron's top 40, and then Big Ron would open the mic and say something like, we talked to Huey Lewis, and he loves golf. And then he'd hit a button, and tape would roll of Huey talking about golf, or, you know, whatever the soundbite was. You could take a half hour interview with Huey Lewis and cut it up all kinds of different ways and use it for a year. And so my partner, Tim Kelly's idea was to take those elements, a script plus these interview bites, and send it out to radio stations across the country so that they each got to host a countdown show that was very personal. And it was hosted by not Casey Kasem or Rick Dietz, but like your guy that, you know, in Tulsa, or, you know, in Des Moines, and he's your guy. And then here he is with Bruce, you know, Hornsby and Huey Lewis and Ray Parker Jr. and whoever, you know. So that was called the Plane Rap Countdown, but we spelled it. We've spelled rap like R-A-P, like you're talking, because we were cool. And that's what launched Premier Radio. That was our first show. Yeah.
So it just started gaining momentum, and I guess labels started seeking you out as opposed to the other way around.
Oh yeah, you know, when if you had Rick Astley for the day, we were going to be one of the radio companies that you called to come over and have him for an hour. You know, so we were. I mean, we would seek out people. We'd call the record label and say, like, you know, we need an interview with, you know, this person or Janet Jackson, or, you know, they were either available or not. I mean, there were in pop music, there were about 5 artists that were just not available, which is not the case in country music. Everybody is available. That's how they roll. But in pop at the time, you couldn't get Prince or Bruce Springsteen or Michael Jackson or, you know, Madonna. Like, there just were people that were just not, they didn't need it. They weren't going to sit there and let, you know, talk to syndicated radio. They were on the cover of Rolling Stone, but like pretty much everybody else, if they were coming up and you were pushing, you know, they could have become a huge star like Whitney Houston. But I interviewed Whitney Houston at the dawn of her career. So,
right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Ellen and Lila have several questions lined up. That was sort of what I was getting at, because I had heard of the Premier Radio Network from the Jim Rome show.
Oh, yeah. Jim was a good friend of mine. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Well, honestly, you answered two of my questions. I was going to ask about the cow sills and how you got into making documentaries, and you already answered that. But I was going to ask, so you have a podcast now, and I was wondering what's your favorite part of podcasting?
I really like the quiet day where I'm just editing. I mean, it's a marathon day and everything, but I don't know. I just really like solitary, quiet work where you can get it the way you like it. You know, writing, editing. I mean, the great thing about creating the Cow Sills doc was that I taught myself Final Cut Pro, which is what I use to edit my podcast. And I mean, I know I could learn an audio program, but it's just what I learned, and you can export audio only. But we also have a YouTube, or I don't know if your show goes on YouTube, but we also put it on YouTube. And then what I do as a filmmaker is I just add like a ton of visuals to the conversation so that if you look at our podcast, Media Path on YouTube, you won't just see the cameras on us. You'll see all kinds of visuals that that complement the conversation. And I just like the filmmaking part. I mean, I do like the interview. I like doing it, and I like having done it, but when you're in the middle of the conversation, you're still kind of like not relaxed. Do you know what I mean? Like you're like vibrating up here, and then when you edit, you're just you have some coffee, and you're just like, oh, I like the idea of writing. Like once computers came out, I like the idea of like typing like a writer, not like it has to be perfect the first time you say it, which is what happens when you're interviewing somebody. It has to really be perfect because that's the way it came out of your mouth and someone heard it. But like when you're typing or when you're editing, you can move things around. And I think I just like the carving of creativity. I like there's something very therapeutic about that for me.
Sure.
How about you? What do you like best?
Well, Ella, go ahead.
I just like getting to know people, to be honest, getting to know new people.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good answer. I love that too. I love getting to know people. Absolutely. Good answer.
What's interesting that you said you use Final Cut Pro. We have that because both Ella and Lila were homeschooled, and we got an educational discount. So I learned a little bit of that. Oh, yeah, I'm like you on the videos. Our podcast is a video podcast, so we add a lot of other video elements that are overlays and
Oh,
slides.
cool.
You know, even some footage that's silent, like John Cowsill drumming on the Ed Sullivan Show. As a little box on the right while we're talking about the Ed Sullivan Show or
Oh,
something.
that's awesome. Good.
Yeah. So I learned that during the pandemic year one. We had a weekly, I think for almost half a year, we had a podcast, I'm sorry, a video show every week. And it was like an old style variety show where there'd be a small interview, some comedy, us playing. It was just a way for us to keep playing and making music and doing something useful when everybody was shut.
Yeah, no, that.
So it kind of forced me to learn video, but so I think in some ways you and I were thrown into a similar thing where we had to learn these things, and I have fun with it. It's just having to get it done if you're actually going to have a schedule. Good thing about us is we don't have a schedule. We can take our time.
I
Lila.
mean, that was nice with homeschool kids that you could rehearse whenever, worked for you and not having to work around their schedules, because kids can be so overscheduled.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it just we're sitting here in our rehearsal room now. Of course, because of our video issue, you can't see that. But when but the thing is, they're just here. Lila and Ella, we're just here at any time, and it's a family, it's a band. It's almost like it's hard to divide. You know, I think it's just one. There's no division between being a family and being a band.
I wanted to ask you, I know this is kind of off topic, but I was just, thinking, you must travel a lot for work with your many different careers. And I was just curious, are there any places in particular that are like your favorite places to visit or you'd love to visit again?
I guess the first thing that come to mind is the music town. So New Orleans and Nashville, I feel are my favorite. I love being around like music hubs, and there's something about them too visually. I mean, New Orleans is every sense, the way it smells, the way it tastes, the way it sounds, and the way it looks so unique. And then Nashville, it's gotten pretty Bachelorette-y. I don't know if you've been there recently, but like it's gotten pretty loud. Like, a lot of bachelorette parties and like a lot of screaming drunk people. But I always love country music. And so I just love the history of, you know, Music Row and how they would have offices in these homes and just everything that grew out of like all the collaborative songwriting spirit. Cause I love songwriting, and I think San Francisco also has a really special vibe. If you guys have never been there, if, like, if you want to pick out two cities that really look more like, almost more like Europe than here, it would be New Orleans and San Francisco, where you're just going to go, oh my gosh, this is awesome.
Well, I've yet to visit San Francisco, but we're very familiar with New Orleans because my wife is from there. She grew up there.
Oh, okay.
And, of course, well, after Katrina, my wife's parents moved up here, but you know, we still have a lot of roots down there. And as a family, we've been down twice. And before I married their mom, they were probably down there three other times. So yeah, I agree. New Orleans is a special place. And, I don't know, just, you know, we people down there, we know people down there, and we it's always like a case of, we can't wait to get back. Mm-hmm. We take the train usually, which is nice.
Oh, that's really nice. And then, of course, New York City, because I love Broadway and like I'm a theater girl, and I just like, I could walk for days in New York. I love that you can walk everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's, for me to live there would be a little bit too much because of the noise.
Sensory overload, I think, that in New York.
Yeah. But whenever I see New York in a movie or in a show, in a TV show, like, it always makes my heart happy. It makes my heart happy that New York exists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope Ellen Lila will get a chance to see a little bit of New York this summer. We are playing some shows up there. It's our first trip. Philly is as far north as we've been.
Okay.
We're finally making New York, some places in New Jersey. We've hit Baltimore, D.C., and we've been down as far south as Atlanta and Athens. But New York, I simply cannot wait to see their faces as we are going through Midtown and so forth. I just think there's nothing like it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a Grand Canyon of buildings.
Exactly, exactly. Question. Lila, you got another one?
I did, actually. I wanted to ask, you know, as you've done a few documentaries, are there any documentaries that have particularly inspired your style as a documentarian?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I guess I have to say Ken Burns, although it sounds ridiculous to compare oneself to Ken Burns, but I love the storytelling and the way that he uses images. And you know, his docs are just so poetic that I really what I do isn't close to what he does, but I've just really been inspired to tell stories through documentary film by Ken Burns. And I think probably anybody that makes a documentary would probably say the same thing.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I love music docs. I love history docs. I love docs that tell a story that you wouldn't have known if you didn't watch the doc.
Right.
Yeah. I guess I have to just say, Ken Burns.
But one of the things I like about your documentary, which I thought was kind of unique, is that for a lot of it, it was Bob doing some narration. You know, he kind of came in and out. Like in the very beginning, he was talking about his show as he loads the van or unloads the car to play the pub show. And then later on, he's sitting there with Shirley Jones or Artie Cornfield or whatever. And it was I don't know. It was just well done. And I like that was sort of a continuity to it. So was that your idea, or was that something that, how did that come about?
It was partially my idea. When you make a doc, you have to tell a story. My first instinct was to tell it from my perspective. Like, here's this fan who grows up and wants to figure out what happened to her favorite group. But the Castles were just like, nope, this is not your story. Which I completely get. Like, it's their family. It's their story. Why would they be, you know, I don't know. Why would they be in my movie about my journey to find them? It's like, that's just, it sounds ridiculous from their perspective, right?
Yeah.
So it had to be somebody's story. And it couldn't be Billy's. which it probably, should have been, because he's the oldest. And basically, he was the first. I mean, Bob and Billy both went to the guitars like in that same impulse of just spirit of like them expressing who they were. But Billy's gone, and Billy died while we were making this. But Billy wasn't, even if he, he was up in Calgary, even if he had been here in LA, like I don't think he would have been well enough to, to tell the story. So, my husband kept saying, it's Susan should be the narrator. And I said, yeah, she, that would be amazing. But the thing is, she was so little when this started. She wasn't on the first album. So for a whole lot of reasons, it had to be Bob's story. And I was trying to do it through interviews with him. But it's hard to cut together the story with interviews, because you're cutting and you realize, there's a hole here and a hole here. And the editor that I wound up working with, Bill Filipiak, he was working with a partner at the time who said, "Why don't you write Bob's voiceover?" And well, that was like the genius idea of all time. Like, oh my God, yeah. So I wrote Bob's voiceover so that we could succinctly have that narration that gets you from point to point to point in this storytelling linear fashion, where you're laying out the amount of story that people need to get them to the next part of the story. Because it's a huge story. It's like there's like eight key players. There's seven Cowsills, one band. But then there's, even within Paul Cowsill, there's Paul Cowsill the child, Paul Cowsill the man. So like with every person, it's even double, right? So it's an enormous story. So the voiceover, writing the voiceover was like a really wonderful technique to use to tell a complicated story about a lot of people who all saw the same things very differently.
Well, it really works, and it just is something that on repeated watches, it really appeals to me, and it very, very, very good choice there. And one thing I was going to say was, like you said, the Bill story or the Barry story could have been their own films. I always found Barry interesting because he was the one that I remember seeing and paying attention to on the 1968 TV special. I thought, my God, there's this young guy. Of course, he was a few years. I'm like a year and a half younger than Susan, so, but still, they seem like, within my peer group in a way. And I was so blown away. I mean, I love the Beatles and I listened to the radio when I was like this little kid who was plugged into AM radio, probably just digging it just as much as you were, even though I was probably five when The Rain in the Park and other things came out. But the fact that Barry's story just had an incredible arc, and same with Bill, as fate would have it, we ended up being friends. Close friends and someone who collaborates with us musically, Peter Holzapfel, who was married to Susan, of course. And of course, Barry has given me a lot of background on making music with Barry in Los Angeles and later in New Orleans. And I think maybe that's how, even how he met her was through Barry. He was recording, and then they said, "Well, somebody else might want to help you on this record," and it's Susan, his sister, and I think I have that right. I might have to double check with Peter. But yeah, and then of course I asked him a lot about Bill, and we were talking about the Blue Shadows and all those bands he had up in Canada. And that's something I've been making sure they are aware of, that even beyond the Cowsills, there's some terrific music made by them individually. Yeah, this the story, but you captured, I don't know. I don't ha see how anybody could have made it any better than what you did. So you should be very satisfied with that.
I'm happy with the way that it turned out, but I could not have done it without Ian Broyles and Bill Filipiak. And there were some other filmmakers along the way that, it was an 8 year, that was an 8 year journey. So there were years where I thought this isn't going to get finished. But, and weirdly, I was perfectly comfortable with that, because I was doing my best and I just knew that whatever is supposed to happen will happen. And so, and that's what ultimately did. But after Billy and Barry died, easily 2 years went by. And Susan and Vicky came over and looked at a rough cut, and they were like, "Yeah, we don't want to continue." I think it was Paul that really felt like I don't know about the conversations that they have amongst each other, like siblings. I'm sure they do. And then one, maybe 2 years went by, and I got a call from Bob, and he was like, "Can you meet me at Cable's?" And I was like, I knew what he, I almost wanted to bring Ian with me because I knew what he was going to ask. He said, "Yeah, we want to finish the doc."
Yeah.
So we did.
Well, I'm glad they did. I guess we're probably about to draw to a close, but Ellen, Lila, do you have anything, any more questions?
No, I didn't.
Good? Yeah. Okay. I think we touched on a lot of the things we had written out because it was such a good, response on so many of these pieces of discussion. Well, Louise,
can I ask the kids a question?
Absolutely.
Because you're living the childhood that I dreamed of. How is, as a child growing up and figuring out your place in the world, like how has your place in this band impacted your sense of self?
That's a really good question.
I guess it's a nice self-esteem boost, I would say. It's nice to know that there are people out there that I don't even know by name who think I'm awesome and I'm good at what I do.
Yeah.
I know that's kind of the conceited answer, but it's the honest answer.
No, it's not. It isn't. It has to do with just self-worth.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange to be, like Ella said, known by all these people who you don't really know. And at such a young age, I'm 17 right now, and it's just like, this is an experience a lot of people my age haven't experienced.
Right.
So it's hard to explain, but it's just such a unique experience. And but I'm really glad.
I think both of them. I think Ella's a little more extroverted, but Lila is kind of quiet and a little introverted. But to see them on stage turn into something completely different, it's a lot of fun because I'm standing in between them and I get to have the best view of them blossoming into the musicians they've become. And it's, I know their late dad would be so proud of them. I know I am. So.
Yeah. Your story is so emotionally beautiful. It sometimes feels like the universe is just kind of like opening its arms and saying, I just need you to come on in. I'm going to give you a hug. And you got to be brave.
That's
and
right.
Go for it. But what you guys are doing is really inspiring other kids to go after their dreams and to say like, hey, it's got to be scary up there on that stage with those lights shining down and everyone looking. And so I'm going to go ahead and apply to this college and see if I can, go after my dream.
Yeah.
Or what, whatever it is. And so, I think that you should take it all in as and know that somehow that you're doing your purpose in a way that's impacting the world and very positively. And also, music is something I think that when it hits people, it just softens them and heals them. And so even just the work itself is contributing something so valuable to the world.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of peace to be gained from pursuing something that is in your heart and then other people actually seeing it and sharing with it. Well, you've clearly done that. I mean, from, being a young kid who was interested in music and then it's pretty much driven your whole life. And then I think that's something that they can actually pay close attention to and see that it's something that they can continue, until they're my age,
Yeah. And beyond. And also I'd say, learn as much equipment as you can. Learn every aspect of music that you can, and then what it leads to, the podcasting or the filmmaking or the photography, or pick up a piece of equipment and learn how it works, pick up some piece of software and learn how it works, because your career is going to be curvy, and your dad will tell you this, is like, and if you can raise your hand and say I can do that, then you make yourself indispensable and people want to have you around. So there's just so much that you can add to whatever your musical gifts, but you can right? Poetry, like, think of all the things that intersect with music. You know, you can write poetry, you can create social media awareness. There's just so much that you can do that complements your band.
Well, it sounds like that old saying, you can make your own luck by having preparation meet opportunity. And I think you've done that. And I think that's something that maybe a lesson that we can learn as well. Louise, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for sharing your time with us. And we've really, we've just sat here and watched your work, but it's nice to see the person behind the work. And it's just, we couldn't have a better way to spend our evening is talking with you about that.
My pleasure, and let me know if you're coming out to LA and we'll get
Oh
together.
my God. We will. It'll be a dream trip for us. We would
Yeah.
totally like to see you there.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Right. Well, we'll see you on the internet, and I'll keep up with you on your video channel. And again, many thanks.
Yeah, thank you
Thank you
so
so much.
much.
Thank you.
Bye, Louise.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.